Hello and welcome to the Jeff and Jamie feed. We're so glad you're here with us. My name is Jamie Brown. This is my husband and business partner, Jeff Tony Dandel.
Business partner, huh?
Yeah, you're both of those things. Yep. And we're going to talk today about seasonality because the restaurant business is heavily impacted by seasonality, and every year we see it. You know, we have the lull of summer, and then we come into September, there's back to school, it gets even worse, and then we move into our peak time of the year, October, November, December. Aren't you glad that it's September?
Oh, September is amazing. We make no money the first week of September. It's always the worst. Labor Day weekend is just the worst sales week after Labor Day. Kids are back in school. It is just a nightmare. We need to go away to some retreat in the middle of nowhere with no cell service
and not look at the numbers.
I do not want to know again. It gets worse every year. They said 162 people are moving to Charlotte every day, and we made less money this year than last year.
That's wild. That's absolutely wild. Well, I feel like when we first got into this business, I was so struck by the fact that throughout the year, you can go for weeks at a time not making any money at all. And so you have to really rely on those times when you are making money to be able to cover the course of the year. Otherwise, your business isn't profitable. But September and January are our two worst months of the year.
It's hard to make up for those lows because the lows can go
infinitely low.
Negative, right? The highs, they're still, you know, our food cost is still going to be 30% no matter what. And our labor cost is still going to be 40% no matter what. So, it's a struggle.
So seasonality, of course, impacts us with those ups and downs. But it also impacts the food, like our menus. We're changing them right now. And a lot of these are menu items that you've been tasting for the last month or two, and now they're coming onto the menu.
Yeah, I get the stuff super early. We push the chefs and we push Colleen, we push the cocktail program, everybody to get us the stuff. So we're ready to roll it out when the season hits. And so I'm usually, I don't know, 6 weeks ahead, a month ahead of before we roll. It's kind of like when they're rolling out the pumpkin lattes at the coffee chains. That's
you're pumpkined out by then.
I have already tasted the stuff, and I think it was 98 degrees this year when pumpkin lattes rolled out. But anyways, I digress. But yeah, so I'm tasting these things, and we have to kind of use what Colleen calls the imaginer a little bit, because we're trying to get ahead and use these ingredients before they're at their peak, and kind of pushing to get them a little bit early. But we go through that process so that when the season hits and when the stuff is ready from the farms, we are ready to go.
We're ready to go. And it's just about that time. I think a lot of our fall menus are going to be rolling out. And another piece of that seasonality, you know, we're talking about how there are these lows and then there are these highs. And it's kind of finding those high times and capitalizing on them. And one thing we're doing this year that is completely different, we've never done this before, is supper in the speakeasy, which is over at Supperland.
Yeah, 10 seats hidden underneath the bar at Supperland. Such a cool space. And what a great place to have dinner. You're going to have your own personal bartender. I'm really selling it now. But it's so cool. It's so quaint. There's so many cool things up on the walls up there as far as liquors that are really hard to get in North Carolina. And I think it's going to be a blast. I want to go.
For sure. But I think the key part of it is that this isn't something we could launch at any time of the year.
Like Labor Day?
We couldn't launch it at Labor Day because there wouldn't be the people to actually make the reservations. We couldn't do it in January. Nobody would be there. But hitting this wave right as people are starting to dine out again, I think that's the key for it. So hopefully that'll be a success.
I think the timing's right. And I love when the seasons are changing, the clothing's changing. There's a lot of stuff going on.
Yep, and seasonality is big for us, but probably none of our partners are hit as hard as our farming partners.
Oh, my goodness. And who better to represent those farming partners than the guy that brings us all of our local farms, Jesse.
That's right. So Jesse Ledbetter from Fresh List is going to be joining us today to talk to us about his business. He's basically a a middleman between farmers and restaurants.
No, I tell him this all the time. No worse place to be.
Two very low margin businesses.
Just take the two low margin businesses.
We will
go right in between them.
We'll get into that. But I think he's also bringing on some produce for us to check out too. I'm so excited to have him on here to talk about seasonality in his business. And we'll bring him in. All right. Welcome here to the Fee, Jesse. We are so glad you're here and you've brought some produce here and we're going to get into this. But let's start with talking about your business. Would you kind of give us kind of a rundown of what you all do there at Fresh List?
Yeah. Thanks, Jamie. You know, I started Fresh List in 2014 as a way for me to get out of corporate life and trying to just figure out what my purpose was. I didn't know what the heck I was doing. I tried to start a technology company that connected farmers and chefs, thinking, you know, oh, we'll fix all this. Why hasn't anyone already done this? Turns out it was way more complicated than I understood. But I'd spent a lot of time on farms in that process and looked a lot of them in the eye and said, I'm going to figure out how to help you. And so when the technology didn't work, we decided let's start a food hub. Yeah, the low margin appeal of it. I gotta get into that.
We invested anyways, though. We're like, hey, we'll support you in this endeavor.
You know, in 2017, when we started the food hub, it was really just me with a vehicle and renting a little bit of cold storage at Lenny Boy Brewing. And you know, Charlotte didn't really have there wasn't a food hub or anyone who was really going around and aggregating from farms. The chefs had to go out and find those farmers and work with them directly. And don't get me wrong, chefs would love to spend all of their time just on farms. But as you all know, they have other places that they have to be. And so we're like, well, this is the connection that we can build and we'll worry about technology later. So we started Charlotte's first food hub. At the same time, you know, I have all of these chefs and the culinary scene in general is gaining momentum. So it's been an exciting time.
How many farmers are you getting produce from right now locally?
So, you know, when we look at our numbers at the end of a given year, we, you know, roughly 200 is about how many we distribute for. That doesn't mean all 200 every week and directly. You know, we have a couple of food hub partners, one in Greenville, South Carolina, a Swamp Rabbit, and then Grow Food down in Charleston. And that allows us to basically extend the seasons on things, because as you all know, it's great to put something on the menu, but if you only have 3 weeks of it, it's going to be very difficult. So
those food hubs, it's basically you're collecting food that can then be distributed. Is that right?
Yeah, that's at our core what we do from a, you know, a transactional standpoint. But, you know, we've tried to understand, like, what is the definition of a food hub? Because there are these food hub networks that are, you know, starting to really take shape, and the pandemic catalyzed a lot of that. But food hubs essentially, we're more concerned about how do we make sure that family farmers are successful and that they're around whenever the market decides that they want to support local. And so we, you know, we work directly with farmers. We do some crop planning. We bail them out when they've grown too many shishito peppers and no one has them on a menu anymore. It really is about just trying to, like, again, we're in this painful point where the market and seasonality of restaurant industry and consumer education or lack thereof intersects with nature and seasons.
Oh, it's absolutely incredible. Cause what you just said was such an aha moment for me, because basically if there's a trend going on, you can start planting it, but suddenly the trend is gone by the time it's time to harvest. And so working through that change, at you can only work so fast. Nature is what guides your farmers. They can't pluck it sooner.
And I feel like we're one of the toughest, because we want all this special stuff.
You mean restaurants in general?
No, I'm saying our restaurant group. We're a major pain, because our chefs would love nothing more than like some super special forage thing. But then we feed over 1,000 people every day. So if we decide to put something on the menu, we're like, oh, Jesse, that's really, really cool. Could we get some of those? And you're like, yeah, sure. And then we're like, we're going to need 16 cases twice a week.
Right. Like, we have one case and it's sold.
Yeah.
Well, that's where, you know, the aggregation aspect of a food hub is we have multiple farms that grow these unique ingredients. And so we are able to provide chefs, you know, longer periods of time where those things are available. But yeah, I heard you talking about, you know, pumpkins, and I used to get upset when people started talking about pumpkins the first time it was, you know, 70 degrees at night. Now I don't, because that's when pumpkins, like, you know, end of August, early September, we start seeing those things come through. And yeah, Colleen texted me a couple weeks ago, was asking about apple cider, and because yeah, I mean
she's got to be R&D. That's our schedule, you know. Right. She's trying to stick to her schedule.
Yeah, and it's hard. It would be different, you know, the seasonality of the Carolinas and Charlotte in particular, where we are in the Piedmont. You have, you know, Appalachia and the Low Country. That would all be wasted if the farmers were just growing butternut squash and, you know, green curly kale and baseball tomatoes. The fact that we have farmers that are growing just such unique varieties of things makes R&D difficult, because you can't just go to the store and find one to test with and then buy your supply local.
Right. How much is that driven by, like, how much of what the farmers are growing is driven by that demand of, say, I know restaurants are probably a big part of it, but also just consumer trends. Are they inspired more to grow, say, a certain type of microgreen or a certain fruit or vegetable in order to hit that demand? Is that a big part of what you do?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. A couple years into the food hub, we had a farmer ask us for the first time, like, what should I grow next season? And I had this, like, simultaneous conflicting feeling of, wow, they trust us enough to ask that. And then also this, like, oh, crap, I have to have an answer.
That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, and so...
But then you're like, but is Sepperlang going to run that Sunchoke special again, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, Aaron Bradley, our first employee and the person who really cultivate all those farm relationships early on, we just kind of said, all right, well, we're not going to tell anyone to just grow these specific things, but what we really need to be driving is just biodiversity. Like, don't all grow the same hard squash, don't all grow the same peppers. And that's hard, because we don't usually find out they all did that until they're pulling them out of the right fields, and then we have to scramble and try and figure out how to, you know, how to sell them. But you know, I'd say the farmers that we have, almost like the chefs in the restaurants here in Charlotte, there's just so much talent and they care so much about their craft and they want to grow unique things. And I think that's one of the values that a food hub provides that I didn't really think about, you know, whenever we started doing the, you know, the aggregation and distribution side, was this knowledge and this ability to, like, connect demand and supply in a way that makes it better for both the consumer and the chef, but also the farm and their profitability.
I don't think the average layperson knows that you're the backbone of every top restaurant in Charlotte. Like, we couldn't do what we do. Everybody would just be serving, you know, carrots and
whatever you could get off the truck. Yeah.
And the same sides if it wasn't for you bringing some cool stuff. What, by the way, speaking of cool stuff, what do we have here?
Yeah, we have a quite the selection. So because we're getting into cooler weather, I did bring a couple of hard squashes. This is a red Curie squash. I believe we're getting this from probably Harmony Ridge Farm up in Tobaccoville. And this is a buttercup squash. So, like, the bottom of it is this.
Oh, cool.
Great. Both these, you know, stuffing pastas and purees and soups. There's just so much. Turns out you can do more with these than just carve them, which I didn't know, cutting triangular eyes into them as a kid. But yeah, the different types of squash, like, I never thought I would get excited about winter squashes.
Well, that has to be it's so great to see, because, you know, I know, like, so much of the bounty of Carolina crops are, you know, in late summer and so forth, but you have to be so seasonally minded. Like, how does that look as winter comes along? I assume these stuff are your bread and butter.
You know, just hearing y'all talk about seasonality, I was thinking about this weird position that, as a company, as Freshless, you know, starting the hub is only, you know, 7 years old in terms of our truly, like, operating as a food hub. There's a year or two of, we didn't really know what we're doing. We're finding our legs, and then the pandemic hits. And so we, as a, like, seasonality and looking at data to see what's going to happen next has been a very difficult thing for us. The only way that that's, like, to have, like, this grounding in seasonality is because we see the stuff coming out of the fields, and we, you know, even if it's just watching Slack channels to see, like, oh, you know, pawpaws are available and they need to go out because they have 8 minutes of shelf life. We're going to talk about pawpaws here in a second. But yeah, pawpaws, this is the largest native fruit in Northern America. They grow in all 100 counties in North Carolina. I came from Texas. I'd never seen one of these. I thought it was a baked potato that was had gone seriously wrong. But yeah, if you think avocados and bananas have a short shelf life, these make those look like
we know they're short because the only way we use these ever, and you know, they just have a real quick season there where they're ripe, is in cocktails. Yeah. So Colleen, our mixologist, is always having, she has a drink every single year out of pawpaw. Yeah. And it's because it's just that little brief moment and then it's got to get back off the menu.
Yeah. It's, I mean, that's one of the good things. Like seasonality is good. Although when you talk about it in the business standpoint, you don't want to have to suffer financially or have these like low points, but it does, you know, the seasonality with food just makes you appreciate when that next thing rolls around. And yeah, these, to have like a tropical tasting fruit that, you know, they grow on trees, basically an understory in wooded areas on the sides of hills and valleys, ravines near water. There's a zebra swallowtail butterfly that it's the caterpillar and only exists on these. It relies on those.
Really?
And so the caterpillar will basically eat the leaves. There's a little toxin in it. I think it's called like acetogen or something. But it makes it to where the insects, other pests won't want to eat the caterpillar because of the toxin. Oh. And so it's able to like live off these. The tree has big leaves.
Poison and then, everybody else.
Yeah, and then it forms the chrysalis, and then you know you get the butterfly. And so if you're trying to find pawpaw trees, you can always look for the zebra.
The butterfly. Oh yeah, my gosh, that's beautiful. Yeah. That's beautiful. And what is this last one that you have here?
This is a grape. You know, most people in North Carolina are familiar with the muscadine or the scuppernong and our grapes. I mean, I grew up eating grapes from the grocery store. There's nice delicate skin and just so yes. You know, no seeds, and then you come to North Carolina, here have a scuppernong, you're like,
no,
what?
Thank
did
you
see yeah. The one was it they were selling them in Japan in those like beautiful cartons, and they would do like 16 of them, you know, placed it would be they would get the 16 best scuppernogs and then ship them to Japan, and they were selling them for $1 a piece or you know something. Yeah. It was like absolutely ridiculous. Just, and they're all
oh my placed. Goodness
it was kind of you know kind of like when you buy like the amazing pears for Christmas and they you know yes. come in special packaging and it was scuppernog grapes.
So this is this like a cross between muscadine and scuppernog?
Yeah,
or what
it's, is it's basically a seedless scuppernog. I don't know if he even has a name yet. It needs a good name, kind of like there's a razzmatazz grape, but it doesn't have the seed, which is the biggest selling point. It's still got a little bit of that leathery you know, the just iconic leathery finish of a yes. grape, which we all appreciate.
What is it about the flavor of this scuppernog muscadine that chefs are looking for that make them want to have it?
To be honest, this is the first year that I've seen these come through. Okay. These grew at Bush and Vine, and I don't know who has used them yet in our crew. I'd be interested to get that answer and see.
It seems like they could be juiced for a cocktail type of thing.
We did something for the summer soiree last year with a muscadine or,
yeah.
or but I don't
I
remember.
I think it was a jam of some kind.
I think so.
Yeah.
I want to take scuppernog and muscadine and investigate making a vermouth with them. I'm like, this is perfect for that.
But yeah.
I have a few projects going on, so I haven't gotten to that. But if you want to do that one weekend,
I didn't realize you had projects going on.
Let me know. you just let me know. Are we going to eat this pawpaw?
I think we should.
Or what?
We should cut open a pawpaw. And yeah. I'm not sure how it happens. Let me move your coffee just in case.
The refined way.
Oh,
you know, just usually these legit. You don't find them. You might find them at a farmer's market. Yeah, this one's so like.
Oh, it looks just a little bit like a mango.
Yeah, and it has these like giant almond-sized seeds.
Do you eat the skin as well?
Or no.
Where's
no.
the poison? Where are the toxins?
Just there you go. Just a spoonful. These are actually. Oh, yes. These are a
it
little
smells
bit,
like a mango.
Yeah, these are a little bit overripe. They were ripe when I left the office.
Did
this
you
morning.
Say you eat the skin or not?
No skin.
No, don't eat the skin.
Okay, don't eat the skin. Okay.
And they're really messy.
Are those are seeds, like almost like a.
It is so sweet though.
Yeah.
Okay.
Feel like a
it's like
toddler.
A cross between a mango and a cantaloupe.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mango just and cantaloupe.
Depending on when you. So I my friends that are from West Virginia were the first ones that told me about them. And they had their patches, like they grow. They have these like runners underneath the ground. And that's how the patch of pawpaw trees spread. But they had a couple patches that were, you know, their secret patches. And, you know, throughout the summer, you see these like little bright green clusters of pawpaws, and they grow. And then basically you can just shake the tree and the ones that are ripe will fall down.
Fall off.
But the flavor profile changes as the, you know, as it goes from the starchy to sugary. There's not a long period before it starts fermenting.
That's awesome. I've only really had it in Colleen's cocktails, so it's nice to actually sit down and get to taste that with you.
And one thing that we we recently hired a new CEO, so
I wanted to talk to you about that because I was so proud of you when I got that investor. We're the smallest investors in the world, but and I got your investor note saying, "Hey, I'm moving out of the CEO role," and I was so proud because Jamie and I we feel like the times we create the most value in our business is when we are able to delegate large chunks of what we do and mm-hmm. step away and have a moment where we're like, I don't know what I'm going to do tomorrow. Yeah. And as soon as you have that moment and really when Jamie started freeing herself up and was like, I don't have any real responsibilities, then she's started just taking on so many things mm-hmm. and creating so much value for the company. And that's when our real growth spurts hit. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited that you've gotten to the point where you're able to do that and move aside and do big things. So what are you going to do, man?
My problem is I've known what I've wanted to do since the moment I had to stop focusing on technology.
That's great.
It is really interesting though. The thought of like technology and how it relates to agriculture and, you know, there's just a lot that technology can't and shouldn't replace in food. But the more that I've been in this system working with other food hubs and part of these networks and seeing the challenges that both the farmers face, the food hubs and the chefs, the consumers, I wanted to be able to spend more time working on those solutions. We hired our first ever director of technology last fall, Shelby Baker, who actually lives up in Fairview in the mountains in Western North Carolina. And, you know, to be able to kind of start pursuing that was exciting, but then I still have a food hub that I was trying to run.
Right.
I know you have to know this about yourself at this point, but if you don't, like your ability to create space for people, sure, the restaurant part of it, like y'all are incredible about, you know, just making a space that just has this, like it invokes all these good feelings when you walk into it. To do that with your business and to be able to be a space where you have talented people who are passionate about the right things come here. I've learned that is something that I also really enjoy and want to try and do more of. And Anthony Miriscotta, the new CEO, I met him when he was running the food hub down in Charleston and we became friends. He has just incredible product knowledge, way more than I do. He's
I mean, dude, you knew about the, a caterpillar, what they eat.
I did know that. But, one of the things that he's doing already at Freshless, like we've had these red curry squash from farmers for years. But whenever he started seeing them come through the warehouse a couple weeks ago, he was like, these need to be cured. Like they're not quite because, they also have starches that need time to convert to sugar, and. So now we are curing squashes before we send them out.
Yeah,
what does that look like to cure a squash?
Just letting it set in a good environment.
Just temperature controlled, holding it there. Yeah. Okay.
With our walk-in, it's, let
it just, it's to sweeten it. Is that right? To allow those sweet flavors to come about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just to let it develop a little
Never
more.
Heard of that. Okay.
Yeah, so that was stuff that he did, down in Charleston with the chefs down there and the farmers was working, like going back to like the seed level and working with the geneticists that were, above a level of Dan Barber and what they were doing. Like, these people, like, how do we breed for flavor and then not just the breeding and growing the product, but also the curing and the quality. So we've always prided ourselves on freshness because of our harvest to deliver model that we have as Freshless, where chefs are ordering by tomorrow at 10 a.m., then we get everything aggregated and then it goes out on Thursday. But this next phase of the food hub is one that's really going to elevate us into a whole different,
world there. And then everybody in Charlotte then is going to have a riper, better experience on the plate, and no one's going to know it's because you guys are taking the time and the storage space and the thought to, you know, keep these 2, 3, 4 weeks or whatever it is. And it really, like, it is going to elevate, you know, thousands and thousands of dishes all over the city just because you guys are making a small change, and no one's going to really kind of have that comprehension.
There are times where I not just okay with that, but like I like kind of being
that behind the scenes
which
person.
Goes against the marketing degree that I got in college, where I'm supposed to be promoting everything that we do all the time. And we did a terrible job of that for the first several years of Fresh List. The people I wanted farmers to trust and like us, and I wanted chefs and restaurant owners to trust and like us. We did those two things very well. Mm-hmm. We tried, you know, we were in direct consumer during the pandemic, and that was just a crazy time. And we recently made the decision to wind that business down, but it's only temporarily because we need to focus on the things that we do well and really build more community connection and engagement before mm-hmm. we try to go back and serve customers. Yeah.
So how does the order cycle work here? Like what, we know you get food to us, but how does that process work?
Yeah. So, every week, beginning on Friday, which is the opposite of how most people's weeks begin, Aaron and Carolyn from our team are basically working with all the farmers, and I say working, like texting them. Sometimes it's a phone call, sometimes it's an email.
Yeah, saying, I get 3 texts every week from you, just so you know. But I like to know when pawpaws are in season, so it's great.
But it's that dialogue of, you know, we'll have a 100 conversations in the course of a few hours. That's what do you think you're going to have next week? Which is it seems like a thing should be an easy question to answer, but nature and how much they may sell at the market, because a lot of our farmers also sell at the farmers market because we work with smaller farms and they need diverse revenue streams and customers. But there's this building out of essentially farmer availability list on Friday, and then we'll get some more throughout the weekend after markets on Saturdays. And then Sunday morning, Aaron puts together this curated list that goes out via text message to about 500, 600 chefs, bakers, mixologists, you know, all across the city, saying, here's what we have. I think there's probably 300 plus products on the list this week. September's great because you'll see both watermelon and hot peppers and also winter squash. The chefs have from Sunday morning until Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. to place their order. And once that order is locked in, our team essentially starts building out purchase orders for the farms. And that's when there's a lot of like, hey, you told us you're going to have all these, here's what we want. And they'll be like, we actually don't have this at all anymore. And so, okay, well now we got to see if this farm has it. And this whole like herding of cats that happens Tuesday from, you know, call it 11 a.m. until the end of the day on Tuesday, we're getting those orders out to farmers. Some of them will start harvesting Tuesday evening, especially in the heat of the summer. Most of them are harvesting Wednesday, and then Wednesday from, you know, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. is when product is just rolling in. We do a couple of pickup routes.
So we're getting, like, the stuff that we get on Friday is, like, picked on Wednesday.
Yeah, most essentially. Of it. Yeah.
Yeah,
there may be some
incredible
things like, you know, like squash or things that we're curing. But, yeah, it's a 48-hour cycle if you're a Thursday customer for Haberdish and Ever Ondolo. Yeah, there's not a lot of time on there and not a lot of miles either. And so our team, you know, we're aggregating that product comes in and we track everything down. So like if we ordered Red Curry squash from Harmony Ridge, he doesn't have it, but Boy and Girl Farm has it instead. We make sure that the invoice that the customer gets is updated and you know exactly where that came from.
Part
of that is just good business and we should do that. Part of that is because we know that chefs will ask or they'll tag a farm, and if that farm didn't actually grow it or have it, they'd be like, hey, what are you doing here?
credit.
Yeah, that's also going back to our website. There's a little list, a link hidden at the bottom called VeriFresh, which was essentially this way of providing transparency to who orders. It's not a list that we go and update once a month or once a quarter or once a year. The only way your name as a restaurant stays on that list is having an order in our system within the past 30 days. Because when I first started getting in this scene and I would, you know, my friends would be like, hey, where do I need to go for birthday dinner? Or I'm in Cotswold, where should I eat lunch? And I got tired of having to like pull up my database of all I did was just pull up QuickBooks and see, all right, well, here's who's ordering.
Who's ordering?
People who are ordering your stuff. And yeah.
Well, one thing that's going on though in our business is, you know, I think 10 years ago, farm to table used to be this huge thing. And it still is this huge thing, but it's more of an expectation. Yeah. Like, I don't think we don't really print our farms that we're doing because it's just like, yeah, of course we're getting everything we can, you know, from you guys that we, you know, that's possible.
Yeah. So. I would much rather see the invoices come through than see, you know, farm names on a chalkboard that may or may not be accurate. You know, for me, we see, and that's why I felt like that list of who is ordering was so valuable, is because that is who is not just saying they want to support local and that they want to work with good ingredients and have a better food system. We also don't expect, like, we've had chefs, aspiring restaurateurs, come to me and be like, hey, we're opening up this new concept and we want to order 100% local. While that would be great for us for the 2 months they were in business, we need people who can incorporate local ingredients into the food cost and make it work more than we need, you know, just let's try and blow it out. Granted, we want to get to a point where everything is local, but we have a long way to go to fix that that problem in this food system.
For sure. Yeah.
So on the marketing side, if someone did want to explore working with you, whether a chef or a commissary kitchen caterer, or individual maybe, how do they reach out to you? How do they inquire about working with you guys? Yeah.
The easiest thing to do is probably to go to freshlist.com, which we've had to rework now that we don't have a marketplace. but there is a wholesale inquiry form there, and that doesn't go to an AI agent or anything. That goes to Matt, Chef Matt. Matt, who ran kitchens. He was one of our chef customers all the way back in 2017, 2018. And he, you know, was starting a family and wanted to still stay in the space, but not stay in the space, but not spend 70 hours in a kitchen.
And I love that your delivery drivers are some of the best chefs in the city.
Yeah, you know, you've like got
when,
some great
when Andy
chefs.
Shows up delivering our stuff, I'm like, oh man, we could use your help today, buddy.
Yeah, that's it really has been fascinating to see as a company, like the types of people that we attract. And you know, there's this being in this hospitality space, which I consider us to kind of be in as well. It's like we're just trying to connect these people that work really hard on both sides of the food system and make it easier.
Well, you guys are a big part of the hospitality industry, and you guys are crushing. And I think it's a secret part, and it's bringing Charlotte's food to another level. And we really appreciate it, and we love all the hard work you're doing, and we can't wait to see what you guys have for us this season and next season.
So yeah, thank you so much for joining us today, thanks, Jesse.
We appreciate y'all's support. Okay. When I go back, y'all were, I think Haberdish was one of the very first customers, and it was not what I thought it would be. It's not like you were buying corn or whatever. Like it was edible flowers for Colleen's cocktails.
That's right.
And it worked because, you know, the flowers, sure, it's part of the marketing budget where, you know, the diners are going to take pictures and tag themselves. But from an agricultural standpoint, you want marigolds and nasturtiums growing within your farm because it's better. You integrated pest management and less chemicals.
Just want them to freeze in clear, beautiful ice balls.
Yeah.
And
I'm
perfectly look awesome.
Fine with that.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Jesse.
Thanks, Jesse.
Okay. Okay, so Jeff, we just had Jesse on here, who is truly like a hero to our restaurants and our chefs, as far as being able to create seasonal menus and just fresh food menus in general. What's your key takeaway or two from him?
I mean, it just blows me away that if we didn't have Fresh List and we didn't have Jesse doing what they're doing, how
and
hard
it would be. And
most cities
don't. Most cities don't have that aggregator there.
Yeah, too. We'd be communicating with individual farms throughout a 200 or 300 mile radius on our own, and it would be super difficult.
Yeah, you'd pretty much have to hire someone to do that job. I mean, that's how we started out when we first just had a couple of restaurants. It was working with those specific farmers, and they would bring that food. I remember them coming in with a basket and bring that food to you and be like, do you want to buy carrots or tomatoes? And we would buy carrots or tomatoes. But now having that system, it just makes it so much more efficient, and it gives access to the farmers, to customers, and us to that fresh food.
Yeah, just being able to plan. I don't think people really realize what goes into feeding 6,000 people a week. I mean, it's 1,000 people a day for us. It's a lot of meals, and it takes a lot of planning, a lot of prep. And a lot of our food is not a one-day process. A lot of it is a 2-3-day thing. So, you know, he's starting his stuff on Friday. We're starting our orders on Monday, and it all has to come together, you know, a week later with a whole bunch of farmers. And one day, mm-hmm. you know, he's saying we're getting our orders here in NODA on Thursday, and they're picking it on Wednesday. That's incredible.
That's pretty incredible. The other big thing that just struck me was, you know, we think we're impacted by seasons, but, you know, we can move on a dime a lot better than he can. Like, if he's trying to, like, have squash ready, well, that's going to be a few months, you know, like asparagus that takes years for it to fruit for the first time. And then, you know, anything like that, it is a slow process. And I wish, and I hope people just gain more, just acceptance, responsibility of the process, you know, an understanding of the process that farmers have to go through in order to make all that delicious food available to people.
It's incredible.
It is. Other key takeaway is maybe I'll make some squash soup this weekend.
Oh, look at you.
I know.
I love it. Our chef. Our home chef.
I know. I just might do that. But really cool to get to taste all these foods. Thanks for bringing all this on, Jesse. And thank you all for listening with us today. And we'll look forward to the next time.